David Baldacci is a graduate of the law school class of 1986. It's a reunion year. He's a true Virginian, born in the state, in the Commonwealth of Virginia, attended the Virginia Commonwealth University and then the law school. He's not only a true Virginian, he's a true lawyer, practiced full-time for 9 years. But as I understand it, even in college, even before college and through law school, if such a thing can be imagined, he was always writing. Not writing the sorts of things that all of us write, but writing short stories and screenplays and fiction. And so after about 9 years in the practice of law, both corporate and litigation, and still moved to write and still engaged in that activity when he could and where he could, he decided, strikes me as a pretty brave act, to make the shift from being a practicing lawyer to being a full-time writer, at which he's had some success. The first novel he published, Absolute Power, became a bestseller on everyone's list. Even those of you who haven't read it may have seen it because it's a major motion picture with directed by Clint Eastwood and starring Clint Eastwood and Gene Hackman and a bunch of other people you've heard of. Since then, I believe there have been 13 novels and seven... Have I got the number right, David? About seven original screenplays and a number of short stories. A lot of activity on behalf of literacy in the United States, in which David is a passionate and effective advocate. And in the aggregate, these publications have sold 50 million copies, which is only 49 million and change more than all the books written by all the law professors on the planet. So I hope that it's with an appropriate sense of humility that I introduce our guest speaker, David Baldacci, class of 1986.
Well, it's great to be back. I was here for the 10th year reunion in 1996, and I like to tell people that I was a graduate of the One Hallway Law School. It's an amazing facility. When I'm out on book tour, I get a lot of questions from people, but I also get this a lot from people. They walk up to me and they sort of say, in a slightly depressed way, it seems like there are a lot of lawyers writing fiction these days. And I sort of look back at them and say, well, you know, some of the best fiction I ever wrote was when I was a lawyer. Another question I get when I'm out on book tour a lot is, what is it like to be a number one best-selling novelist? Your books are sold and read all over the world. And I know the way that people ask the question, they expect some glamorous, glitzy answer. Like, I get up at noon every day, you know, and I have a smoking jacket that I put on, and I have a furry little dog that I carry under my arm, and I walk down with my pipe clenched between my perfect teeth, and I have a bunch of people waiting to write down my every utterance. It's not like that. So instead, I tell them a true story about my kids. Until my daughter was 3 years old, she didn't think that her dad wrote books for a living. If you ask my daughter what her dad did for a living, she would say automatically, my dad signs books. My daddy is a professional book signer. And he does pretty well. She must have passed his wisdom on to her little brother. My son, when he was 3 years old, I took him to a bookstore for the first time. He walked in, he saw all the people, all the books, his eyes grew really huge, and he took off running at the top of his speed across the bookstore, screaming at the top of his lungs, my daddy will sign any book you have for $2. He's 10 years old now, and even now when I come back from a book tour, he's sort of waiting at the door, how'd you do? You know, college is expensive these days, Dad, so you got to keep that up. Now, as a novelist, all I have in my quiver to entice, enthrall, excite you are little printed symbols on a page that we call words. I don't have any pictures. I don't have a cool movie soundtrack for you to listen to. I just have little printed symbols on a page. When I was here at the law school, while all my classmates were doing the much smarter thing by trying out for moot court and law review, I was back at my little apartment off a hydraulic road and writing short stories. I knew I wanted to be a lawyer, and I felt like I would be a good lawyer, and I felt like I would be practicing law for most of my working life, but writing was a passion that I had. I was a kid who grew up and discovered you could buy a blank page book at a store. And I would buy a blank page book and I would go out and write things in it. I would go out and look at people and listen to them and just watch things. I was very curious. When I was in law school, actually, I would come out after class and I'd sort of stand in the hallway and watch people go by and see how they were talking. And I actually thought I was mentally ill, but... But it turned out I was just a writer, I guess, because we are just innately curious about people and things. Now, reading is the only form of entertainment, if you want to call it that, and you certainly can, that demands your participation. When you read one of my novels or any novel, it's only a template. It's unfinished until you sort of put your mark on it, because you will bring to bear on the stories your own philosophies and ideas and opinions about things. And everyone in this room could read the same book and come away with the same number of conclusions about what the story is supposed to mean and what the characters are supposed to represent. And that's why reading is not really for lazy people. You can go to a movie, you can go to a concert and be sort of lazy, sit back and enjoy what a director thinks a story should be, what a musician thinks a song should be able to tell. But with a book, you have to give a little piece of yourself to it. I started out as a short story writer, and I wrote short stories for a number of years, and I tried to get them published, starting in high school. And I sent them off to obscure rags you've probably never heard of, The New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, even Playboy magazine, which, in addition to the photographs that it publishes, has some very fine fiction in them. And I got a lot of rejections back, a lot of rejections. And I found out, too, that every major periodical in the United States uses the same small firm in New Jersey to print their rejection cards. Because they all read the same. And no human hand has touched this card. It's all electronic. And it says, "We hope this finds a place somewhere." Talking about the story that I wrote with my blood and my sweat and my tears. And then it goes on to say, "Rest assured, that place will never be here." But what are rejections? I've always treated them as badges of honor. Because when you get a rejection as a writer, it shows you're doing two things. One, you're writing and finishing something. All of you here have written something. And you know it's not that easy to do. And then you've taken something that you created, very personal, and you've sending it off to a stranger, probably to just trash. Because a lot of times you'll send it off to someone that either they don't read it, they don't connect with the material, they're having a bad day, you're actually a good writer and they don't want you to know it, and you get a negative rejection back. But it's a badge of honor. And the only way you truly lose in any walk of life when you get a negative something back is if it dissuades you from following the passion that you set out for yourself in life. And there are a lot of great writers, I think, who have been dissuaded because they've gotten negative feedback back and they just decided to hang it up. But as a writer or as anything else in the creative process, you have to have a thick skin. You really have to have a thick skin. And if you have a love of writing or love of any type of creative process, I think that'll carry you through. And it'll prevent you from sitting down and saying, "I'm just no good," when you get a rejection back that says, "By the way, we only represent talent." Because I've gotten one of those too. I actually met the person who wrote that little note to me at the world premiere for Absolute Power in Los Angeles. And he came up and he said, "You know, one, congratulations, and two, I guess I was wrong about you." And I said, "Well, you know what, maybe way back then you weren't wrong about me, but I stuck with it and I think I got a little bit better." I moved from short stories to screenplay writing, and by now I was practicing law in Washington, D.C. And a friend of mine went out to Los Angeles to break into film as a producer, and he came back about 3 years later, not successful, but that happens to a lot of people. And he brought with him what was then an unproduced script, and he asked me to read it, and I read it. And he said, "What's your opinion of it?" And I said, "My opinion is clear. It sucks." There was no real character development. The humor was all potty humor. It wasn't even really a story. It was like a series of disjointed vignettes. And I was convinced no one would make this drivel into a film. However, Austin Powers went on to become an enormous hit. Really big. I'm sure none of you saw it, but millions of your fellow citizens did. And I guess it showed I had no taste whatsoever in screenplay writing, but nevertheless, over the next 4 years while I was practicing law in D.C., I wrote screenplays. And I got an agent in L.A. Based on my screenplays, which, let me tell you, it's very difficult to do when you live in Virginia. I'm not sure many people in Hollywood know there are actually two Virginias in the 50 states. And they're confused that there is a West Virginia and a Virginia. I was out there for for a meeting once, and with an executive I'd never met before, and he was sort of looking around for some small talk, and he said, "You're from Virginia?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm from Virginia." And he said, "Oh, good. How's the cotton crop coming?" Yeah, I just stared at him for a long minute because I thought he was joking, and when it became apparent he wasn't joking, I said, "Well, not too good, but we have high hopes for tobacco." And he was like, "Good. I'm glad to hear that. Very good." Well, I had an agent for a screenplay, and I thought, maybe I'll be a part-time screenplay writer, sell some scripts, you know, help make some movies, and still practice law. I had never thought that I could ever retire from practicing law. It just wasn't in my makeup. I had a family to support. That was a solid paycheck. I actually enjoyed some of the work that I did. I actually enjoyed some of the people that I work with, and I could see myself doing this for a long period of time. Well, about the time my screenplay career was starting to take off, I finished my very first novel, which turned out to be Absolute Power. If you haven't read the book or seen the movie upon which it was hardly based, it's a very simple story. I think the best stories have simple main plots, and as a writer, I can complicate that plot by a lot of different devices and machinations. But all great stories have simple plots, and the plot in Absolute Power is very simple. The President of the United States is not a really nice person. He has affairs with women. During one of these trysts, something really bad happens. There's a cover-up. Eventually, the truth comes out. At the end of the novel, he's impeached by the United States Congress. Now, when I wrote that story, it was entirely original. I have spent the last 10 years of my life explaining that Absolute Power was actually written when George Bush the First was president, and not written when a president you might be thinking about now was actually in office. But it was a good story, and it propelled me to the tops of the bestseller ranks, and all of a sudden I was a best-selling thriller writer, when I didn't start out with an ambition to be that at all. I certainly enjoyed reading mysteries. I enjoyed writing them. They were a challenge to do, and my career really took off. Now, when you have written as many novels as I've written, and you travel as widely as I travel across the country and countries overseas, a really curious thing happens. I see a lot of people out in public reading my books, and I have one rule about that. If I ever see you out in public reading one of my novels, rest assured I will never come up to you, ever. That's my rule. Well, I broke my rule, and it had really dire consequences for me. About 4 years ago, I flew into LAX in the middle of a book tour, and I got off the plane, and I just wanted to go to baggage claim, get my bag, go to my hotel. I had a busy day the next day. I'm walking down the concourse to baggage claim, and I see this guy standing in the middle of the aisle with his luggage around him, and he's standing there reading a book. My first reaction was, my God, it's midnight, this guy's standing reading a book in the airport. He must have not a life at all. My second reaction was one of curiosity. I'm a writer. I have a lot of friends who are writers. I was thinking, what the hell could he be reading? As I walked by and looked back, I saw he was reading a copy of Absolute Power. Then my dilemma was sort of obvious. You know, I sort of stood there vacillating back and forth. Should I or shouldn't I? I got this rule, you know. Finally, I thought, this guy looks okay, and I walked over to him and I said, boy, it looks like you're enjoying that book. And he didn't even lower the book. I couldn't even see his face. And he said, yeah, it's a page-turner. Really, really enjoying it. I said, well, I'm very happy to hear that. Would you like me to sign it for you? I asked. And the book came down a little bit so I could see his beady little eyes staring at me. And he looks me up and down in a really unflattering way. And he said, no. I don't want you to write in my book. And I took a step back. I felt like an idiot. I said, sir, I'm so sorry. I actually had this rule about not doing what I just did, but I saw you reading the book. You said you enjoyed it. I just thought you'd like it autographed, you know, because I wrote it. And he looks me up and down again, and he says, no, you didn't. And I took another step back, you know, trying to keep it pleasant, upbeat, and I said, actually, sir, ironically enough, Absolute Power is my very first novel. I am David Baldacci. So then he pointed a finger at me. I won't tell you which one. And he said, look, freak. You are not David Baldacci. And get the hell away from me. You know, I can only assume this happens a lot at LAX. You know? Well, by this time, a small crowd had gathered around us. I'm actually a really nice guy. I'm a calm guy. It takes a lot to get me upset, but this man had pushed my buttons way past all tolerance. So I said, "Excuse me, sir." I ripped the book out of his hand. I flipped it around. I held it up to my face. Big picture of me on the back of all my books. And I said, "Do you see, buckaroo?" "I am David Baldacci." So he looks at the picture, looks at me, he gets a really sheepish expression on his face. He reaches in his pocket for a pen. He's looking down at his shoes and he says, "Mr. Baldacci, what an honor." We all know what's coming next, don't we? He said, "Would you sign my book for me, sir? It'd mean a lot." So I looked at him, I smiled, what could I say? I slapped him on the back really hard. And I said, "No." But I did. I signed it for him. One of the most bizarre things that ever happened to me was an issue with a foreign publisher. My works are translated into 41 foreign languages, including Arabic and lots of others, none of which I can read, but that's okay. And they send you complimentary copies, so I have thousands of foreign editions at my home, at my office. If you ever come and visit me, I will ask you, one, I'll say hello, and secondly, I'll ask, "Do you read a foreign language?" Because if you do, you'll be presented with one of my books in a foreign language, because I'm out of room. But in all these foreign languages and all these countries, the name on the book is David Baldacci, except for one foreign country, one foreign language. My agent called one day around the time that Absolute Power was just about to come out, and he said, "I have in my office right now with me your Italian publishers, Mondadori, the largest publisher in Italy. And they love Absolute Power. They think it's going to be a huge hit. They have a problem with the name." Now, I thought he was talking about the title of the book. And I said, "Well, you know, if Absolute Power doesn't translate well into Italian, you can go ahead and change the title. If you go to Germany and try to find Absolute Power, you'll be unable to do that because it's known as Der Präsident in Germany." He said, "Well, no, they love the title of the book. It's going to translate beautifully into Italian. Their problem is with your name." Now, for those of you who thought that Baldacci was Irish, it's not. It's Italian. And I was stunned. I said, "Well, the Italians have a problem with my Italian last name?" He said, "Yes, it's a big problem." I said, "That's interesting. The Latvians don't, the Koreans don't, the Dutch love me. Why would my own country not want my name on the book?" He said, "Well, it's very simple. Italians don't think that other Italians can write." So I thought about that for a couple of seconds, and I said, "Well, that's interesting because, you know, Dante, Puzo, and Machiavelli had pretty good careers, didn't they?" He said, "Well, much like American movies, people want American thrillers. So American thriller writers with Italian names, like a Steve Martini, they've had to change their name. Lisa Scottolini, I think she's called Lisa Scott in Italy. Steve Martini is Steve Martin, not to be confused with the comedian." He said, "So if they market Absolute Power with David Baldacci in the title, they'll think you're an Italian-Italian, not an Italian-American, and they think that your writing is awful, and they won't buy the book." And I said, "Well, what sort of a name do they want?" He said, "Well, they want an American name." I said, "Well, that's fine. I mean, they understand we're a country of immigrants. We're all from somewhere else." He said, "Well, I can tell you're upset. Why don't you take a few days to think about it? You can call me back." And I said, no. "If they're in your office right now, you give me 5 seconds. I'll come up with the greatest American name you've ever heard." He said, "Okay." So I remember I put the phone down and I thought, "Oh, crap. Now what do I do?" Luckily, I glanced out the window, and back then, in the driveway, we had an Explorer, and I saw the big blue emblem, and I picked the phone up and said, "I want to be called David Ford." Right away, my agent said, "That sounds American." My agent is devilishly quick, you know, he just, boom, right on it. "Let me try it out in the Italians," he said. So I hear him telling the Italians. He wants to be called David Ford. The next word I hear is screamed out by a gentleman so loudly I can hear him, even though he's not holding the phone. And the word he screams out is this: "Genius!" The Italians are very passionate people. So my agent gets on the phone and he said, my God, they love it. David Ford is perfect. How did you think of that so fast? And I said, hey, I'm a writer. This stuff oozes off of me 24/7. Now, I do a lot of research for all my novels. For those of you who read them, I hope that you can tell that a lot of research has been done for the books. And sometimes research can get you into trouble. I was on the Amtrak Acela train going from Washington, D.C. to New York one time. And I was sitting at one of those tables where, you know, I'm sitting here and two people I don't know are sitting across from me. We're just sharing the table. And these guys are businessmen with their Blackberries and laptops and cell phones and nuclear-powered whatevers. And I'm on my cell phone, and I'm making a call to the medical examiner's office in New York, in the Bronx. And if you talk to medical examiners in New York, they all want to try to get to the Bronx office, because they'll tell you that the Bronx has the most interesting wounds. Apparently, people kill themselves in the Bronx in the most creative ways possible, and they want to get there. Well, my purpose in calling her was simple. I just wanted to set up an appointment with her so I could meet with her face-to-face when I was in New York and talk about this issue that I wanted to address in my novel, her particular specialty. Unfortunately, she said, look, I'm leaving the country on special assignment. I'll be gone for 3 weeks, and I'm leaving in 2 hours. I wouldn't be in New York by that time. So I can either talk to you when I get back, or we can do it right now. Well, my schedule didn't allow for me to wait 3 weeks for this, so I said, well, I don't usually like to do this on the phone, but let's go for it. So I had my questions, and I said, look, Doc, this is basically how I want to murder the guy. And I went through my poisoning technique with her. And I said, look, I have to be absolutely certain that the police, when they investigate it, won't even know I've killed him. They won't? Great. I'm writing that down. Now, I said, as you know, there's going to be an autopsy, so I have to be able to make sure that I've fooled the medical examiner as well in how I've killed this person. I will? Great. Write that down. In fact, this woman said, you know, this is the perfect murder. She goes, I've dreamed of killing people. This is the medical examiner in the Bronx. And this is the way I would do it, because no one would ever know how it was done. I said, well, that's high praise coming from you. So I asked her a few more questions, and I finished by saying, I got to tell you, doctor, if I ever need to kill anybody else, I'm going to call you. So I clicked off, I finished writing up some of my notes, and I looked up. This guy over here had spilled his coffee from his neck to his crotch. And this guy over here, right across me, was just sitting there going like this. So if you ever read Split Second, the novel this was in, the last acknowledgement in Split Second reads something like this. To all passengers on the Amtrak Acela train, who might have overheard me discussing poisoning techniques with various experts and were probably scared out of their wits at my seemingly diabolical intent, I apologize. So not only will I never come up to you if you see I see you reading one of my books in public, you will never see me on my cell phone in public either. I have a website. I never wanted to have a website. And the big reason was that I went and looked at other author websites. And they were set up such that if you breathed on the screen, your Visa was somehow charged for all of their books. You know, you ever been to one of those websites with like, pick me, pick me, pick me? But my website is totally non-commercial. You can't buy anything on my website. You'll learn about me. You'll learn about the novels. You'll also be able to download for free a lot of stories that I've written and had published in magazines and newspapers all over the world that have never been published in this country. And a lot of them are sort of funny satirical pieces, so hopefully you'll enjoy those. And you'll learn about all the charities that I'm involved in, too, which is very important to me. They're all hot linked to our website. The name is www.david-baldacci.com. I had to put a hyphen in between my names because somebody bought my name and came to one of my book signings in North Carolina, and he brought 5 or 6 of my books for me to sign for him, and he also brought a contract. And it was sort of a little tongue-in-cheek. There wasn't a purchase price listed that he would sell my name back to me for. But he said, it's the same purchase price that Louisa May Cardinal was offered by Southern Valley Oil and Gas in your novel Wish You Well, which was $500,000. He was a lawyer. a member of the North Carolina bar. So the Virginia lawyer and the North Carolina lawyer, we stepped outside for a few minutes and talked about the matter, and I didn't pay him any money, and I thought it was kind of repulsive what he was doing, so I put a little hyphen in between my name, and that's how you get to my website. We found out a few weeks ago, though, that he's finally given up the name. It was funny because he sold it to another firm, so if he went to davidbaldacci.com, it popped up to a retail outlet. It was saying things like, David says, fly northwest to Detroit. David says, take this cruise. And I guess you could do that with names, and I know there are squatter rights, and I probably could have sued him, but for me, it really wasn't worth it. But now we have the name. So if you put it in with the hyphen or without the hyphen, you'll still get to the website, and I hope you enjoy it. A few years ago, my wife and I, Michelle, she's in the back there, we founded the Wish You Well Foundation, which is named after one of my novels. And we did that to eradicate what we perceive to be probably the biggest issue, problem that we face as a country, and that's the one of illiteracy. And also alliteracy, people who can read but never do. And this is a tough sell. I live in the Northern Virginia area, and I speak a lot in Washington and those environs, a very affluent, highly educated workforce. And to tell them that a lot of people are illiterate in this country, they sort of look at you and they just shake their head. They can't believe it. But it is true. In 2003, the National Education Center had their census literacy survey taken. And they did a massive nationwide poll, and they graded everybody on their five levels of literacy, five being the highest and one being the lowest. And out of the 180 million adults in the United States, 90 million adults polled at the two lowest levels of literacy. Number one level is you can't read at all. The number two level is you can read a grocery list of about three items, or someone tells you a word, you can find the word in a newspaper article, but you have no chance to understand what the article is actually about. So 90 million Americans read at those two lowest levels. Only about 30 million Americans out of the nearly 200 million adults in this country read at level five, which is roughly a 9 to 12th grade reading level. So it's a big problem. Illiteracy is tied to every social ill that we have. You know, 50% of the inmates, 60% of juvenile offenders, 70% of the people on welfare are all illiterate. When I go and give speeches around the country, if I do something for a particular state, I ask that state, give me statistics about your state. And I did a speech in Kentucky a few years ago, and Kentucky's stat was that 25% of the entire population of Kentucky own not a single book in their home. Or 61% of low-income households in Georgia own not a single book suitable for a child, or that nearly 20% of the entire population of Tennessee is illiterate. And then all of a sudden your brain thinks, oh, it's a rural southern problem. I get it. Well, you know, I guess we're always going to have that. Unfortunately, the region of the United States that did the absolute worst on the National Census Literacy Survey was the Northeast United States of America that has most of the major metropolitan areas in this country. Now, why is literacy so important? I mean, reading, you know, people read for fun, right? Well, not actually. It's more than that. A democracy is founded upon a literate population. And as Winston Churchill once said, a democracy is the worst form of government that we have, except for all the others. So it would be nice to keep what we have. But I don't think a democracy is sustainable with an illiterate population. It's never been done before long term. And we think in language. We think in language. We don't think in symbols. We think in language. So how deep can our thoughts be if our language is not up to the task? The most tyrannical countries in the world have several things in common. In the United States, our greatest rights are tied to words. Freedom of speech, freedom of the press, exercise of religious freedom. Oppressive regimes offer none of that to their citizens. I read an article a few weeks ago that had an interesting sort of element to it. They said the first thing that dictators do when they take over a country is they close all the libraries. Why is that? Well, it's full of a place of books and ideas and differences of opinion. And those things are more terrifying to a dictator, to an oppressive regime, than the greatest army in the world, because that means the change can come from within a population, from within a country, which is always long, sustainable change, rather than from external pressures. If we solve either of the problems that we have as a nation, but we don't eradicate illiteracy, it won't matter. It won't matter. We can't solve the healthcare crisis without it. We can't solve any crisis unless we eradicate illiteracy, because it all stems from those sorts of issues and problems. Now, I'll close with two anecdotes that I hope illustrates this problem. The first is the importance of words to someone. And the second story is how one book can change someone's life. Here's the first story. And I think I'm eminently qualified to make this statement because I have done book signings in 43 of the 50 states and over 15 countries overseas. So here's the statement. Readers are shameless about what they will ask a writer to inscribe in a book. Oh yeah. You know who you are. To Maria, at least we'll always have Paris. David. I've done that one about 20 times. I've also done to Peggy, at least we'll always have Pittsburgh. David. One woman came up to me and said, you know, Mr. Baldacci, I've heard you write anything in a book that someone asks you to. And I said, well, ma'am, I mean, within reason, sure, I'd be glad to accommodate you. She said, terrific, you've made my whole life. Here's what I want you to write. To Debbie, I hereby give half my book royalties. And see, this is where the legal training came in. I said, Debbie, you know what? I'll write it out, but I ain't signing it. But there's one inscription request I think will stand alone, at least in the annals of my book signings. It happened a few years ago at the end of a 30-city nationwide coast-to-coast tour. And I was really tired. It was near the holidays. This is the last event. And I just wanted to finish this event and go home and spend the holidays with my family because I hadn't seen them in a while. A long line of people, and I'm signing as fast as I can until there are only three people left in line. There's a guy with a bunch of my books, and there are two young women, probably in their early 20s, behind him. And the women are together, and they have one copy of one of my books. While I'm signing the guy's books, I'm committing the curse of the writer. I'm eavesdropping on the women, because writers eavesdrop shamelessly. They do all the time. It's amazing what I've heard here today, actually. You can read about it in the next book. But in my defense, these women were having a very interesting conversation. The one holding the book whispers to her friend and says, you know, that guy in front of us has a lot of books. Maybe I can use this as an excuse to get out of here. Not something I really like to hear at my book signings, but there you go. Her friend's response was even more cryptic and even more unsettling. Her friend whispered back, you can't leave without getting that book signed. It's a matter of life and death. All right, well, I'm totally freaked out of my mind by now. The guy leaves, the women come up. She plops the book down in front of me. She leans really close and says, Mr. Baldacci, have I got a special request for you? I said, I'm sure you do. She said, my name is Amy, and the person I want you to write the book to is Tom. And Tom's read all your novels, and he's heard you speak, and he values your opinion. And if you write what I ask you to write in this book, and he opens it on Christmas morning and reads it, it'll change both of our lives forever. Now, she went on to tell me that Tom had asked her to marry him three times. She didn't tell me what she told Tom on those three occasions, only that poor Tom had gone to the well thrice with Amy. Here's what she wanted me to write to Tom. Amy loves you with all of her heart. Amy would love to share her life with yours. Amy accepts your proposal of marriage. And then, dear sweet Amy, added the immortal words, and you know, whatever else you want to write. So she looked at me and said, you know, will you write it? It's sort of important. And I said, Amy, I can see that it's important. And I thought about it for a minute, and finally I said, you know what, Amy, if you have the courage to come up and ask a complete stranger to write something that significant in your life, the complete stranger should have the courage to actually do it. So I wrote everything she asked me to write. And the weird thing happened is like the holiday spirit seized me, because I kept going. I wrote down one page, I turned the page, I wrote down another page. I wrote three pages on Amy. Bringing to bear all my gifts as a storyteller, as a wordsmith, let me tell you, that prose was sparkling. By the time I had finished, she wasn't Amy, merely a mortal woman. She was Saint Amy. Tom never had a chance. So she read what I wrote, she was laughing, crying, she hugged me, she thanked me, and off she went. And I'm packing up to go home, feeling sort of good about myself. And then it struck me what I had done. And I started to pray. please, God, will you let the marriage work out? Because look, if Amy's not nearly as saintly as I wrote that she was in those three pages, and she turns out somehow to ruin Tom's life, he's coming for me. And ever since then, every book signing that I've done, and it's been hundreds, a little piece of me is always looking for Tom. Now, the second anecdote is how one book can change your life. I practiced law in D.C. for almost 10 years, and most of that career was spent at a small firm, 10 to 15 lawyers. I liked that a lot. You felt like an entrepreneur. You knew your clients. You're sort of growing with your clients. You knew the other lawyers in your firm. And then in my last year in practice, we were swallowed up by a really big firm. So instead of David Baldacci, I sort of became, you know, attorney 587. And during my tenure there, I was assigned to work with a senior partner on an acquisition. And the senior partner was described to me as a very anal person. That may stun you, you know, but lawyers sometimes can be anal. He never wrote in pen. He only used pencil. And he had a secretary sort of arrangement that the points sharp end up. Once they ever got dulled, he would flip it over so the eraser was showing, and that was her cue to come in and sharpen the pencils for him. So anyway, I was assigned to work with him on this acquisition, and he asked me to call the lawyer up on the other side. And it was an amicable acquisition. They wanted to be bought. Call the lawyer up on the other side and confirm that three facts were true or not. So I called the lawyer up, and I asked him, and I wrote everything up in a memo and sent it to the senior partner, and he read the memo, and he called me on the phone, and he said, "Did you write this memo?" And he read it to me, and I said, "Well, yeah, it's from me. It's got my name on it. I wrote it." He said, "You called him up on the phone?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "You wrote that you received a verbal representation that the following three facts were true?" I said, "Yeah." "And you listed the three facts?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Come to my office." So I schlepped down to his office and went in and closed the door, and we sat down, and he said, "Read the memo to me." He said, "Well, I called attorney so-and-so on the phone and received the verbal representation the following three facts were true." And I listed the facts, and there we go. He said, "Okay. Do you know the difference," he asked me, "between oral and verbal?" And I sort of looked at him, and I thought about it for a minute, and I said, "You know, quite frankly, in my whole life, I've never really had occasion to think about that. But if I thought about it, oral is spoken language, whereas verbal technically could encompass both language and sounds, like a monkey grunting." He said, "Precisely. You didn't receive a verbal representation, you received an oral representation. I don't tolerate imprecision in my lawyers. Don't let that happen again." So the whole time he's talking to me, you know, the theme song for The Twilight Zone is going off in my head. Over and over again. And I said, "You know what, I'm really sorry. What could I say? I'm really sorry for the oral-verbal snafu thing. And I'll be sure never to let it happen again. Probably by never using those words again together." And I went back to my office. Everybody in life, we have to deal with, you know, unpleasant situations like that from time to time. And for me, as soon as I left his office, it was over. It was done with. Okay, you move on. Well, it wasn't over from his part. That same day, in the inner office mail, I received two items from this gentleman. One was a big poster. I have no idea where he found the book, but he found a book, and he took a page out of it and had it blown up and put on poster board. And the page from the book said, "How to Tell the Difference Between Oral and Verbal." And it had six bullet points to help poor schmucks like me who didn't know the difference. And the second item he sent me in the mail was a book, and that book was How to Write Well. I thought it was a bit of overkill for the oral-verbal thing. You know, as fine of an education as I got at this law school, nobody ever told me about that while I was here. Well, it was embarrassing because everybody in the firm sort of knew this had happened. You see the mail coming back and forth and secretaries talk, and it was embarrassing for me. So the very next day, my first novel, Absolute Power, sold for the most money ever paid for a first novel in the history of American publishing. And I went up to New York that day. I sort of lied to the firm and said I was sick. And I went to New York to Time Warner, and they gave me a party, and I signed the publishing contract, and the movie deal was done that same day. And you have to understand that all those years I was writing, no one knew I was writing other than my parents, my wife, close people. Most people that I practiced law with never even knew that I put pen to paper as far as fiction writing. My in-laws didn't even know I was writing all those years. Can you imagine having to call my father-in-law, who's a big guy, and said, you know, all the years I've been married to your daughter, I've been leading this secret double life. You know, thank God he was 2,000 miles away when I said that. So anyway, I went to New York and had a great time up there, and my intent was to come back to my firm in D.C. and sort of explain, this is how it happened. You know, I've been writing all these years, et cetera, et cetera. While I was in New York, my agent slid a piece of paper under my nose, and I looked at it, and it was an article, a newspaper article, with a caricature of my face and the whole story about me. And I said, where is this from? He said, well, it's in the Wall Street Journal today. Well, as you know, every law firm in the world probably gets the Wall Street Journal. So I called my office in D.C. and I said, and talked to my secretary, and I said, has anybody by chance sort of happened upon this article? And she said, happened upon it? The whole firm is shut down. You know, all 11 offices across the country, they're all out in the hallway talking about you, and they're saying, who the hell is Attorney 587? That must have been some book he wrote. So I came back to D.C. the next day, and people were very, you know, congratulatory and encouraging, and I sort of told them my story, and I went back to my office. I was still working there, obviously, and I sat down, and I saw the damn book on my desk, How to Write Well. And I thought about it, and finally I concluded that, David, you will never have another chance like this in your whole life. So I picked up the book, and I walked down the hall to the senior partner's office, and I knocked on the door and went in. He had read the article, too, so he knew what was happening. And I held up the book, and I said, with as much sincerity as I could muster, I just wanted you to know how much this book has changed my life. Thank you very much.